Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 44 of the Stage Left Podcast with the Ivor Novello winning songwriter Ian Dench, who's written songs for Beyonce, Shakira. He was the writer in EMF, so he wrote that classic international hit Unbelievable in the 90s. We're really, really pleased how this episode turned out, so we hope you enjoy it. For more episodes featuring Jennifer Batten on what she learned touring as Michael Jackson's guitarist for the Bad, Dangerous and History tours, Billy Burnett on an extraordinary decade in Fleetwood Mac, Shane Keyser were on playing at Graceland and touring for two tours with Elvis Presley, and John Woff of the 1975 on being saxophonist with truly the biggest pop band on the planet right now, and loads more. Go to thestageofpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at thestageofpod, like us at facebook.com/thestageofpodcast, and let us know where you're listening from. We've also got an Instagram page where you'll see photos of all the interviews that we do, and we're available on Spotify, iTunes and all podcast apps to listen to. We do this for love aside two other jobs, so if you want to buy us a coffee for our troubles, you can at our website. Our next episode is with Dan McDougall, who not only drums with Liam Gallagher but recorded all the demos for the what is now the platinum album As You Were. It's very revealing. It was great fun doing that interview last week in Barcelona, so we hope you enjoy it. So that's coming up soon, but here we go. This is Ian Dench. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Today we have the Ivor Novello winning, Grammy and Golden Globe nominated songwriter Ian Dench, who, not satisfied with writing the most infectious guitar riff of his generation, now collaborates with some of the most talented artists on the planet. Our guest today has written and co-written five songs with Beyonce, as well as hits for Shakira, Florence and the Machine and Ian Brown. Today we'll be breaking down the creative process in the modern age of songwriting, telling some classic stories from the EMF days. We'll be finding out how Ian tailors his approach to each artist he works with, and most excitingly for me, we'll be discussing what it was like recording a hit single with Vic and Bob. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than the original Epsom Mad Funker Ian Dench. Thanks for joining us today, Ian. How's it going?
Hello. Yeah, I'm very good, thank you. Very good. Thank you for that great intro. you really built me up, thank you.
There we go. So we're going to begin because last night there was the sad news that Marquis Smith of The Fall passed away, and you just mentioned that you actually supported his band once, is that right?
Yeah, long time ago in my band before EMF, up in Mosaic, we supported him, and our dressing room was above his dressing room, and I think we were making too much racket, or, you know, dancing about on the floor or something, and his wife Britt came upstairs and told us to shut up, and she was very nice about it. She was very nice, but I think we were just like a annoying young band, and you know, they were making such interesting, important music at the time, and you know, and it is a very sad passing, because he was a man who sort of, you know, explored new territory, and sort of, you know, he's a sort of testament to how personalities can sort of trump form sometimes. You know, and I think, you know, it was just by sheer sort of intellect and personality he made great work, you know, yeah, a very important artist, and it is a sad news that he's gone.
Yes, very sad news, and thank you for speaking about that. Before sitting down to research this interview with you, I wonder, how did someone from EMF go from working in EMF to kind of where you are now with some of the people you're working with? And I listened to EMF stuff in detail for the first time in the last week or so, and it really struck me how, like, sophisticated some of the songwriting was. And for me, EMF, you know, as a kid growing up, they were the band who obviously very well known for Unbelievable and kind of a few naughty stories on tour and that kind of thing. As the main songwriter, did that frustrate you at the time that perhaps your craft was being overlooked with the headlines about what the band were up to on tour and Unbelievable taking all the attention, if you like?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it was a great meeting of personality and you know, and music, you know. And I think one of the reasons that it was so successful was that, you know, it was a bunch of young-looking guys with loads of stories about it, and you know, it was a whole story around it. And thankfully we had some good music to back it up. So it was a great package, I think. And that's why it worked so well. And also it was just great fun. You know, they're just a great fun bunch to be around, always were and still are. And
you're playing gigs at the moment, is
that? We've been playing an occasional gig, yeah. And
how's that been going? Tell us
great.
About that.
I mean, amazing. Just so fun to still be doing it, really. And doing it because it is fun. You know, I think back in the day, we toured so much, it just became a little bit wearing and we got tired, really. Just, you know, we were on the road for so long. And so now we just do the occasional festival and it's great fun.
For that kind of thing, do you need lots of rehearsals beforehand, or do you just meet once a year and just on the stage and play? How does that work so you can get back in the groove?
Well, I definitely need a rehearsal, because when you don't play for a couple of years at my age, you end up forgetting all those bloody guitar solos. I wish I hadn't written so many bloody guitar solos.
Some of them really complex as well. I was listening to them today, and I know you probably won't want to say, but some of them very complex. Yeah, so you must have to get your chops on it.
It takes a couple of goes through to remember them, and then I'm off.
And so do you just listen to the records, or do you just book a rehearsal, and how does it work?
Yeah, I listen to the records and try and remember them, and then get in and have a rehearsal.
There was a couple of songs that really stood out to me listening to them. There's one song, I'll tell you, it's the best chorus I've heard in about a year, and this is a song from quite a few years ago. First time I heard it, called The Same.
Ah.
Oh my God, what a tune that is, with that descending chord progression that I think you arpeggiate over. Can't get enough of it. Maybe you can shine a light on that tune. What's your memories of that tune coming together?
That's so interesting that you brought that one up, because we've only just put that one back online.
Right, yes, that's, yeah, I saw, yeah.
Because that was part of...
was the Unexplained EP, is it?
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
Exactly. Which we did just after Schubert Dip, so after the first album. And it's interesting how you brought up the whole sort of, I don't know, the whole stories thing above music. With the first album, you know, we were on the front cover of the, you know, teeny mag smash hits a lot, and I don't know, we sort of felt perhaps we'd been, you know, overlooked a little bit, because we were, you know, considered to be teeny pop stars or something. You know, people say, oh, they're just like New Kids on the Block or something, and it really get our goat. And you know, we'd been listening to Public Enemy and The Smiths and trying to put all these things together into our music, and so we sort of made a conscious effort after Schubert Dip to do something a little bit harder and a little bit darker. And that was the Unexplained EP, and so the Same was sort of part of that thing. And there was something about, you know, I don't know, about the sort of monotony of being on tour. I'm not even, looking back on it, I'm not even sure what that song is about.
Yeah.
But there was something, I don't know, you know, after going, you know, do you still feel the same after all this stuff, you know?
What
we've been through all this stuff, and like, we'd had this, the band had been started because we had this great vibe and we were having fun, and then we went through all this stuff, and is it still the same? Well, you know, I think that's what that song is about. But it's so strange, that song was lost, you know.
Yeah,
that song has never been online
for
so long.
It's unbelievable. That chorus is so, so good. And another one I really, really liked, Shining, which is off the Cha Cha album, is that right?
Yeah,
that is a great. Now, that's, the strings are really fundamental to that, and they're probably the most prominent instrumental part on that track, or instrument on that track, if you like. Can you remember how that song was put together? Because that's a really interesting one, because it is darker compared to the first album.
And I knew you were going to ask about songs off Cha Cha Cha. and that was a dark period, I suppose. I mean, it was, again, we were just probably exhausted. We'd done two albums back to back, and then gone away and sort of tried to write another one, but probably just lost our way a bit. I think we weren't quite sure what we wanted to be. We sort of wanted to be cooler, but, you know, we had this pop legacy, and you know, and we just started writing these songs, and some went this way and some went that way. And Shining, I guess, was a little bit, it was a sort of precursor to what happened to Zach, in a way. And And you know, it was that it was a sort of feeling about like young people going wrong, and I don't know what sort of song it was meant to be. It was sort of, we were working with Johnny Dollar, and Johnny Dollar had produced the Massive Attack Blue Lines album,
right, okay,
and
that those
sort of big things with those orchestral arrangements, and so I think maybe that influenced the way it went, and we sort of did this whole string section in Abbey Road in the.
That was at Abbey Road.
That was a wow, 40-piece string section.
And, sounds it, yeah,
yeah, with in the room where the Beatles did all those recordings, and it was a great moment. It was a sort of sad precursor of what happened, really, and that whole album was just a mess, really. I think we were all a bit of a muddle, and I think it shows.
In what way?
Because the songs. This song a little bit this way and a little bit that way, and even sort of our attempt at pop with Perfect Day was so atonal, and it was we were just sort of sabotaging ourselves all the time. We were like, okay, we'll write a pop song, but we make the chords so, you know, hard that, you know, nobody's going to accuse us of being a pop band, and it just was self-defeating, I think, and I think we just should have written some good songs and been happy with who we were, and because it was good.
When I say to you the word unbelievable, as in the song, what's the first emotion that comes to your mind?
I'm just very happy, really, because it's just been an amazing thing in my life, and it took us all over the world. It just gave, you know, EMF as a band an experience that few people have had, and you know, we went number one in America. We all made lots of money. What can I say? I think that's a great thing.
Is it true that you came up with the riff whilst riding a bike? Or is that a myth?
That is the truth. That is the absolute truth. I had a bedsit on one side of Gloucester Park, and my parents had a piano in their house on the other side of Gloucester Park. And I used to go to my parents' house and you know, play the piano because I pretended we were doing house piano on my mum's on my mum's upright piano, and you know, I just been playing a bit, and I just was going home to my bedsit, riding across the park, and you know, all those songs at the time I was writing them about my ex girlfriend, and they're all like, you know, lies and sort of there's some bitterness because she dumped me, and I just thought, well, you know, you're unbelievable. That's interesting. You know, it's got the two sides to it. You know, you're sort of a liar, and you're and also, you know, you're amazing, and then riding my bike, you know, and this riff in my head, and I just went back to my bedsit, played it on the guitar, you know, wrote the lyrics, and then took it to the rehearsal with the band, which were happening sort of once, twice a week, at that stage, and bang, and it was born.
And you talked about the impact that had on you, kind of from a holistic point of view, from a grander point of view. At the time, that obviously really kind of saw a peak in your career. How did that affect you as an individual?
I mean, I must say, initially, I couldn't quite believe it, and I had struggled away for years. I'd been in a indie band, and we'd had a couple of record deals, and hadn't sold a record, and struggled, and then all of a sudden, bang, you know, something, I got it right, you know. And it's interesting how you brought up, you know, the stories and the other things, and you can see how that had contributed. And also, you know, years of songwriting, and you know, I'd been in an indie band where I tried to be like my record collection, and I'd been a bit of this and a bit of that, and it had never sort of gelled, and so I thought, okay, we got to write a song, we got to write an album that's got, where the songs sort of are coherent, where it's got a direction and it's got a look, and we're sort of, you know, and it's got somehow it's a, you know, a thing that exists in its in every dimension, and we, you know, and so we got it right finally. But I'd sort of paid my dues, and I must say, initially I was thinking, look, this is a bit too good to be true, and I didn't sort of believe it, and it was great. It felt like playing a role, and it was fun, and I hope it didn't go to my head. But even after, you know, after a couple of years, you can't help it, because people say, oh, you're so great, and yeah, you're amazing, and you start sort of believing the hype a little bit, and then you think you're so important.
And how do you change then?
you know, you sort of think, oh, I'm so successful, anything I do is important, you know. And I think you just forget that, you know, people love listening to music because music is speaks to them about their lives, that, you know, there are melodies and, you know, sounds that they that excite them and inspire them or touch them. And I don't know, you know, you can't just sort of disappear into your own little world. You know, you must remember the audience. And
yeah,
and I think that's something I'd done more and more and more as I'd moved towards EMF. You know, and I was thinking, you know, you've got to try and connect to the people. Mm. And I think ultimately why I had a bit of success, because it's about connection, and connection's not a bad thing, you know. I mean, I think that's where you have to get that difference between pop and connection. You know, pop is about connection.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's connection to a lot of people. And sometimes you get connection that's you know, to young girls, that's just a bit sort of one dimensional and then perhaps you get things that are deeper and don't connect to so many people. And then you get, but it's, you know, pop is not a dirty word. It's like, it's about, you know, making that connection with people. And I'd sort of been moving towards that more and more, and we had that success, and I think we really got it right, and then sort of moved away from it. And I think that's sort of I think that's a shame. And I think I came back to that myself later on and sort of thought, okay, well now, you know, I need to make these songs that connect to people again. And you know, not to try to be so obscure, not so willfully obscure. And
is that a challenge?
Is
there a part of you that wants to be that kind of willfully obscure as you describe it?
No, I don't. I do you know what? I'm not good at being willfully obscure, and I never have been.
Interesting. I don't want to be. I guess. Right.
But
yeah.
But what's just as bad is pretending to be pop. You know, and because I think really good pop is real. And I think either is as bad. You know, being willfully obscure and just trying to be cool is just as bad as being willfully pop and just trying to cheese it up to connect to as many people as possible. Because I think real pop is really good and really does touch people. And just as, you know, real honest music does touch people. And I think, I sort of think they're the same, really. And it's interesting talking about it and trying to articulate what the difference is between those things, but really they're the same. I think they're music, and they touch people, and people put them in categories and say this is cool and that's not cool, but I think they're certainly on the same scale of you know, mass appeal or lesser appeal, but you know, they, you know, good music touches people.
When you're writing now for different artists, I'm interested in what is the input from. Do you get blueprints from record companies who say this is going to be for this artist and this is the kind of thing we're after, and you have to write to a blueprint? Or is it a case that you've written songs already and then pass them over and they can do with them what they choose to?
Both of those things. Often there are briefs attached to how an artist or a band, how their image is and how their sound is. And, you know, you can try writing to a brief and trying to fulfill that, you know, with your will. Mm-hmm. And you know, sometimes it's great when somebody says, oh, you know, we need a song like this. And you're like, oh, hang on a second, I got a song that's just right, just like that. And
great. And often do you know who the artist is going to be so you have them in mind? Or in most cases, are you writing something for a particular genre?
Often, again, both. Often, right. You know, yeah, it's sort of great if you've got an artist in mind, because it can guide you. And sometimes it's great just getting in a room and writing a song with people and thinking, oh, well, that's a little bit like that, and just following where it takes you. And it is hard writing to a brief because you sort of force it into those sort of your understanding of how a style of song is or how the sort of message that a singer might sing is. Whereas perhaps if you do something from your heart about how you're feeling now, it feels a bit more authentic and a bit more real. And then you can sort of let it go where it goes. But if you're involved in commercial music, you sort of have to understand what's being played on the radio or what an artist's fans expect from them and make sure that you're going down that style.
Is that what happened with Ave Maria? So I'm guessing the blueprint there, Ave Maria, which I think is a hymn, a classic kind of classic, using a bit of that with Hallelujah, with the arpeggiating, perhaps the Jeff Buckley version, because it's not quite prominent on the Leonard Cohen version. Kind of a dollop of Ave Maria, a slab of Hallelujah, go bake a cake. Is that pretty much how it works?
Well, that's funny you mentioned Hallelujah, because I'd never thought of that one. But yeah, Ave Maria.
Really?
Absolutely. Yeah, really.
Oh, man.
We were working with Beyonce on this I Am Sasha Fierce album. Mm-hmm. When I say we, Amanda Ghost and I, who I wrote all those songs with.
Yeah.
And Amanda and Beyonce got married the same weekend.
Right.
And they both had Ave Maria at their weddings.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, in classic American hip-hop style, why don't we just, you know, take the riff and, you know, write a song around it? And that's what we did. So, you know, I just sort of borrowed the sort of feel of Schubert's Ave Maria.
Which is a nice recall to the first album by him.
Right, okay, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I love Schubert. I've often gone to Schubert to borrow a chord or two and, you know, it's just got the Ave Maria. And then we wrote a song about sort of saying there, but for the grace of God go I, you know, and just sort of wrote some things about Beyonce and Bish Bash Bosh.
Do you ever get to work with Beyonce, or is it a case that...
Like, that was with Beyonce, yeah.
Beyonce was in
the studio, yeah.
And what was that? Tell us about that process. How does that work, the kind of to and from? So you've written a part and she sings it, or is it a case that you do it together? How does that work?
I mean, she was very open. She sort of said, look, what you got? And we played her a couple of songs. In fact, I think she sang 8 songs that we played her, 4 of which ended up on the record. And then Ave Maria, we wrote there in the studio, sort of, about her, about with her. And it was interesting, you know, although, you know, she didn't necessarily come up with the ideas in the other songs, you know, she her vocal arrangements definitely made them her own. You know, what a voice, and it was incredible.
What would a young musician learn from working with Beyonce that they might not learn from working with anyone else?
She's the first one to get to the studio. She's the last one to leave. So even at that stage when she's incredibly famous, I mean, I don't know, who knows, now she's got kids, maybe she wants to get off, but she worked incredibly hard and she was open. She was not, you know, in terms of creativity, she was not a diva. She was like, yeah, let's see what you got. I'll try anything. I think that's great. That's like, she's not like, oh, it has to be like this or it has to be like that. You know, it's like, well, let's see, let's give it a go.
Subconsciously, does it affect you as a writer? Do you think knowing that this is definitely going to be heard by a colossal amount of people?
Yeah, I guess. I guess it sort of makes you a bit nervous. You're like, ah. But also it's, I don't know, it's sort of, if something's sort of real and authentic, and it touches you, you sort of know that you know, probably going to touch someone else as well. And so, so great, you know, when somebody like that sings it, and it's very exciting.
So back in the 70s, Berry Gordy, who ran Motown Records, he asked his team of writers, to for every Jackson 5 song, he kind of asked them to write in a way so that a listener would know within the first few bars who the artist was, even if they didn't know the name of the song. And it's an interesting experiment to kind of play this, because even people who've not heard these particular Jackson 5 songs know it's a Jackson 5 in the first few bars. Something that's kind of cropped up in the last 15 years is, and I find it a slightly kind of ugly thing, is artists kind of name dropping their own name in the first few bars. And in Beautiful Liar, which I know you wrote, and I'm sure you didn't write this as the lyrics, which I know you won an Ivor Novello for, the first thing you hear is Shakira and Beyonce say, Shakira, Beyonce. And then I think it becomes the lyrics for the final chorus. And interestingly, after Michael Jackson passed away, with some posthumous, some recording that he'd done that was released posthumously with Akon went, Akon and MJ at the beginning. And it's like, we've already proven you don't need to do that with Michael Jackson. So were you under instruction to include stuff like that? Is that something that's in conversation beforehand from the record company? How does that work?
Do you know what? She just sang it on there.
Right, okay.
You know, the rest of the song Amanda and I wrote, but yeah. She just got on there and went, Shakira, Shakira, Beyonce, Beyonce. And I think Shakira just went, Beyonce, Beyonce. And I think she was just riffing.
Is it contrived? Is it product placement? Is it so that as soon as the radio comes on in someone's office or in a public place, it's like, okay, yeah, so we know who it is?
I think probably a little bit, yeah. Especially with a duet like that, you know. And it also establishes them on an equal footing.
Yeah.
And there's that whole video where they look the same. And
yeah, yeah. What are your memories of composing that song? Because, I mean, that was a huge, huge hit, obviously.
Well, that was a great moment because Amanda and I were in New York. Amanda was playing a gig and I was basically, you know, in Amanda's band. Amanda was an artist. We wrote the songs together for her. It was Amanda. But Amanda had just happened to write You're Beautiful with James Blunt.
Yeah.
Now, Amanda hadn't written songs for other people either. And she just happened to meet James Blunt and written that with him. And that was just starting to be a success. Mm. And Amanda said, oh, I got this phone call from this guy who, he said, I love, you know, You're Beautiful and I want you to write a song for Beyonce. And I'm like, she's like, this. I don't know, it just sounds a bit creepy. I don't know, you know, so will you come with me and, you know, meet this guy? And I was like, yeah, sure, let's go see what this is about. And so we turn up at this address and lo and behold, it was the Universal Building on Fifth Avenue. And we went up and, oh, it was the Def Jam offices. And we went in to meet this guy, Tata Smith. And he was like, oh, there's somebody I want you to meet. And in walks Beyonce and Jay-Z.
Oh.
Whoa! And they're like, oh, we want you to write a song for Beyonce. And Amanda's like, well, you know, I don't usually write songs for other people. And, you know, I'm an artist. And I was like, shut up, Amanda, shut up. And they were, you know, Tata was like, well, that's what we want. You know, we want a real song. We want an artist song. And we sort of said, oh, well, great. You know, well, you know, we can get to know you and like work in the studio and come up with something, because that's how we wrote songs at the time. You know, we were in a band, you know, you'd come up with an idea and try it with the band and try it this way and try it that way. And Beyonce said, I haven't got the time. You know, here's the backing track. This is going to be a duet with Shakira and I. We got the studio booked tonight to come and, you know, come to the studio at 8 o'clock.
Wow.
And we were like, what? And but it was such a great opportunity. So Amanda and I basically wrote Beautiful Liar in the taxi on the way back to the hotel, in the hotel for a couple of hours, and then finished it off in the taxi on the way to the studio. And bang, we played it. But there was, again, I suppose, you know, so many years have been leading towards that point. I mean, the backing track had a sort of Spanish guitar feel, which was the Shakira bit.
Yeah.
And it had the Stargate sort of hip-hop drums, which are the Beyonce bit. And, you know, I played sort of Spanish guitar, and so, you know, I just played my Spanish guitar stuff, and Amanda sang it like Beyonce style, and so the bits all came together, and it sort of wrote itself, because it had to be about female empowerment. It was Beyonce and it was about two girls, and it just sort of, the bits fitted into place and they liked it, and bish bash bosh, and they just did it.
So the key to winning an Ivor Novello is to write in a taxi.
Yeah, exactly. Just don't think about it too much. Boom.
Just do it. That's fantastic. So do you play on some of the records? Is it you playing instruments on some of the records? Or is it a case
The Beyonce records, yeah. I didn't play the guitar on Beautiful Liar, but on Ave Maria, that's me tinkling the guitar there on Satellite.
Disappear? Yeah. Is that another one that you do with Amanda? And how does yours and Amanda's working relationship, I wonder if you could tell us about that. Obviously, you've written some stuff with her for many years. What are her qualities? What are her strengths? What does she bring to the party?
She's pouring with ideas. Amanda's just like, she's got so much energy and such a sort of force of will. And so these ideas are coming out. And I think I just perhaps temper her a little bit and you know, give a little bit of form to them and just say, oh, I think that's a good one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think this is leading to here. Maybe I just edit her a little bit. And that was a really good relationship. And in 2008, a very fruitful relationship. But Amanda's also a great businesswoman, and she was given the job as president of Epic Records in 2009, and she asked me to go with her and do that. And so we sort of left the songwriting a little bit behind at that stage and worked at Epic together, which was an incredible experience. She has gone on to make movies and is presently doing more of that and sadly writing a little less. And I sort of came back to doing some writing because I miss the creativity and perhaps business is not my strong point. But we still work together occasionally, you know, when inspired. And we've been doing some work with an artist, Joel Compass, recently and together, and that's been great. And we wrote the music for the Halcyon TV series, which is great together. So, you know, I count her as a very good friend and an incredibly creative person, and I hope we always will work together.
From a technical point of view, how would you say you personally evolved Beyoncé sound in the tracks that you've been involved in?
I think the I Am Sasha Fierce album was an attempt to mature. And I think some of those songs that she did really were mature songs, like The Satellite and Disappeared and Ave Maria. You know, they were a move to something deeper. And although I say what's funny about that record is that Single Ladies was the big hit off it.
Yeah.
Still. So I think, you know, Beyoncé's strength always was that sort of sassy pop. And
yeah.
And it's interesting because If I Was a Boy was meant to be the big single off it. And, you know, the Single Ladies, the B-side. And
really?
Well, it was a double A side. Certainly when we were involved, they were all talking about If I Was a Boy, this is going to be the big record. This is going to, you know, Beyoncé is going to move into a sort of more mature direction and Halo and that. But, you know, she just did that dance and that, you know, great.
Yeah. It's iconic, isn't it?
You know, riff in Single Ladies was just Beyoncé in her element. And so I'm not sure that she necessarily followed the sort of darker, deeper, you know, direction. Quite rightly, she went on to do more sort of upbeat things, and I think that's what she's great at.
What's your memories of Once in a Lifetime? Because were you involved in the writing of that one? That got a Golden Globe nomination, didn't it?
Yeah.
And that was part of the film Cadillac Records.
That's right, yeah.
So what's your fondest memories of recording that?
Well, we wrote that with Scott McFarnan, and we went to see one of Beyoncé's representatives, Jay Brown, and he was staying in the Hilton by Hyde Park. Mm-hmm. And so we went up to his hotel room to play him this song. And Scott got the guitar out and played. And I can remember looking across Hyde Park when he played the song, and he did such a beautiful performance. I mean, of this song. And you could see Jay Brown was like, oh, we have to have this song. You know, this is just a great song for Beyoncé. And she tried it and sounded great. And that was it, really. And, you know, some of the songs, it was just like that. As I said, she was up for trying things, and it just worked for her. And
when you've written hundreds of great songs or riffs, which you have, where is the creative well you go to when you've got a blank sheet of paper in front of you?
There's a question. You know, I don't know really. You just got to sort of try and find a word that resonates, or think about your life really. I mean, I like working with people who are a bit loud or got a bit of personality, and I like to tap that, you know, and try and help give it some form. I think the things I write myself these days are sort of slightly darker, and I mean, I still work with James from EMF because we have a really good chemistry, James and I do, and we've been writing some songs, and that's great because he's got a really good energy, and he comes up with things, and I just again sort of edit them and send them in the right way, and then occasionally throw an idea in there, and you know, maybe it comes back to that thing we started with about sort of having a look at the whole picture and about how that's going to connect to someone, you know, because you can get very lost when you're sort of throwing ideas out there and thinking about your life and how you feel, because you feel it, you're in your own head and you feel something, and when you say it, it means it to you, but does it connect to someone else? Does somebody else feel it? Do they understand it? And I think I've always been a bit of a policeman about whether somebody else understands it. And I think that's why I like sort of taking an idea and refining it until it's like, yeah, you know, you just get this sort of sixth sense when a song hits a level where you don't know why, but you think, oh, that means something. That's making me move. That's making me feel. That's making me think. And I like sort of chopping it and changing it and trying this and trying that, and until it does make me feel something. And
when you have that feeling, when it makes you feel something, how do you then feel having to hand over your song to a producer who can change it up and chop it up potentially? And you put an interesting face there.
Yeah, that's a two-edged sword, because on the one hand, you know, I don't know that production is my strongest point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, although I did produce Unbelievable with Ralph Jezard, and I got involved in the sounds and the way it should sound. I think as I've got older, I think I've come across a lot of younger people who are so much better at it than I am.
Mm.
Especially these days, you know, new sounds come and people are just really good at Ed, who you just met.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's so good at things. I love working with him. And so I think you have to be prepared to hand it over to somebody and let them run with the ideas, but also, you know, police that the emotions are still coming across, and it's good, you know, I know enough about production to sort of, you know, understand why something might be working, something won't be working. And so, you know, I still stick my tuppence worth in, and you know, I'm the annoying voice at the back of the room is like, oh, you know, that's not working, we got to try it this way, or but I'm fine, you know, I like collaborating. I think collaborating is a great thing. You know, you certainly get more than you give up, I think.
Yeah. What about, so other than key changes, what are the specific changes to your approach when you are writing for someone else to sing?
Yeah, for me, I think I like to understand the person and make sure that something comes from them. You know, I'm happy to be transparent. I love it. If I can work with somebody, even just organize an atmosphere in the room where they are, you know, they can write a song that really means something, I'm happy to do with that. You know, I won't take any publishing. You know, fine, you know, just write a song that's great and means something to you. You know, if I can be instrumental about that in some way, that's when I've been successful. And hopefully I can help musically. Hopefully I can help with lyrics, which is what I do more and more of these days. It's like, how are you saying that in a way that somebody will understand, you know, or feel? And I think that's what I get involved with more and more. these days.
Have you got any examples of that, when you've particularly come in with particular lyrics, or you tweak stuff?
I suppose, you know, that was my role with Amanda, you know, and when we wrote Tattoo, you know, she had this great stream of consciousness stuff coming out with the melody, and, you know, and she's like, oh, I want to call it Tattoo. And I knew that if you had to write a song called Tattoo, you've got to use the image where, and I just think, you know, I just said, well, it, you know, and you're on my heart like a tattoo, you know. So
nice.
You know, it's just, you've just got to be that clear and that direct and that sort of honest about it. And then, and two, when we were writing the song Red, that Daniel Merriweather did.
Yeah, that was a huge hit, wasn't it?
Yeah, that did really well.
So I don't really listen to much pop, and I listened to that song, I was like, I knew the chorus. Like, it showed, yeah. It's so interesting how that bleeds into every walk of life, doesn't it? A song like that. Really knew that chorus.
Yeah. And, you know, we wrote that one with Scott McFarlane as well, and he'd had this sort of line about his dad, and I can't do this by myself, something about the... all of the problems are all in your head. And again, you know, so, and Amanda was there going, we have to write a song called Red, you know, and I was trying to give it some form, you know, because Scott was like, you know, it's about my dad. And Amanda was like, you know, we need a word like red to encapsulate this. And I said, well, you took something perfect and you painted it red, you know.
Nice.
And so, you know, to try and find form for the emotion. And again, you see, that's, I always think you've got to try and find a punchline that says it in, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be in a narrative way, but in a, like, an emotional way that involves a narrative. And I guess that's what I still, what I try to do. You know, we've been writing a song with, I've been writing a song with James, from EMF, with James Atkin. And I was just thinking about that today. It's called People, and just trying to find a way to say something about including people and just sort of, for me, that's the crux of it. It's like, when to try and take the emotion about including people, but, you know, how people should be, and something about, do you feel, you know, how all the evil's filtering through, and then people, can I hear you? No, all the voices behind the noises, they're all people too. And so it's just trying to find a way to tell a story with emotion, and that's what I love. That's what I try and get, is what the person, the singer, is trying to say, and I try and give it form. In a way that people would understand and feel.
That's a fascinating insight. Thank you for that, Ian. What skills do you think people who have really kind of made it, like yourself, in the music industry have, that are kind of overlooked by young people? So what are there any transferable skills from jobs you had when you were very young before you made it as a musician that you think, actually, that allowed me to do X, Y, and Z?
I managed to keep doing what I'm doing because wordsmiths are rarer than the other skills involved in the music industry. I mean, this is,
why is that?
I don't know. I mean, there's some great wordsmiths, you know, great young pop writers. But I think maybe there's a tendency to dumb things down because that sort of people feel like that's what pop songs need. I really don't think that's the case. You know, I think you get, I mean, I love those Chainsmoker things. You know, it was so simple, and that melody just went round and round and round. Those rhymes, what were those rhymes in the Chainsmokers about, you know, because where he's right, you know, in the backseat of your Rover that I know you can't afford, bite that tattoo on your shoulder, pull the sheets right off the corner of the mattress that you stole from your roommate back in Boulder. I mean, it's genius. It's like it's poetry and just like a strange random lot of rhymes. I mean, but it's really clever.
There's no need for it to dumb down. You just mentioned that it could be a case that it's dumbing down. To what end? Why do we need to do that?
I mean, I think simple is good.
Yeah.
And again, that comes back to being understandable. I think it is. It's an art. And I think, you know, having a love for storytelling and a love for words is a great thing. I mean, like that again, Ian Brown. I mean, he's a master. I mean, he just had a turn of phrase, and again, simplicity and emotion, and you know, what a wordsmith. And Fear. I mean, that
such a great song. That,
just isn't it? Well, you know, there's a joyful word, you know, and a genius. And
Actually, talking about Ian Brown, because we were going to come on set. So you involved in a couple of songs, including For the Glory. So he actually had a Stone Roses references in that song. I don't know if you remember. Was that something you put in there, or was that something?
Do you know what? That was Amanda.
No, that was very nice. So what was your memories of working with Ian?
Just that he's a lovely man, and that he is a talent. You know, he's somebody that. It has a personality, you know. He's got something to say, and I just had a great way of saying it. And just, you know, I mean, it's pointless going on about me working with Ian Brown, because he's the talent, you know. He made it work. And
on that record, you weren't involved in the, because they were going to do one song that was supposed to be, that they started doing a song on that record, and it sounded quite a lot like In the Year 2525. Right, okay, so it was In the Year 2525, and they realised, actually, we're ripping off that song, so we'll just do a cover of it instead.
Great.
Right, and they end up releasing it as a single. But one question I did have about songwriting, are you owned in regards to who you can write songs for? Can I ask that as a songwriter, when you get into that position, is there limitations as to who your songs can go to? No, you can...
Yeah.
That's good.
You can write with whoever.
That's good.
Why would you think that?
Well, I just wondered if it was a case of if an artist is, like a record company, owns a particular talent for writing songs, and it might be a case that they can only write for the people on that label or anything like that.
You know, maybe that was a case back in the day with Motown or something.
Yeah.
They were in-house writers.
It was, yeah.
That and was they had exclusive... Yeah. Right, and perhaps as artists they are, but certainly songwriters these days don't work.
So you could work with whoever.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody invests a lot of money in somebody being an artist, whatever they do, a record company would want to own, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But as writers, no, you want to write with whoever you can. And
what are examples of techniques you've seen producers use to get the best out of either yourself? Another artist in a recording studio?
This isn't something I've seen used, but I always try and do this. I can remember hearing about how Brian Eno, when he first started working with, I can't remember who it was, he made them all dinner. He just wanted to put people at their ease, I think, and then, you know, let the creativity happen. And Brian Eno did an amazing remix of Unbelievable once, and I got to chat to him.
Really?
And, you know, and I picked his brains a little bit. And in those days, he was just using a couple of bits of equipment, and he'd just record lots of different things on these, and then start editing it, you know. And I think it's very much like a sort of throw it at the wall and see what happens, and, you know, keep the good bits.
Do you ever do the thing where it's like, oh, this is just a guy take?
I put my computer on there and just press record and just run a thing, and we just sing things, and you know, and people are like, oh, I forgot. It's okay. I've recorded it. And then we go back and listen to things and just sort of let it happen organically. And
So I wonder, Ian, if you could tell us, what are some examples of, or the best examples you've seen of techniques used by producers to get the best out of people in the studio?
I love that story Brian Eno tells about how he always makes people dinner before he gets started. And I like to put people at their ease and ask them about them, really, because I work with singers. I myself am a terrible singer, and I like people to feel comfortable enough to talk about themselves. The best one is always to ask, you know, are you in a relationship as well, you know?
Really?
And, yeah, when people get started on that, you know, then you start to see what they really feel about stuff. And of course, relationships always get to how people feel. And
is that dependent on what the song is that they're going to be singing, or just does that just cut through to the emotional core straight away?
Yeah, it just cuts through to the emotional core.
Wow.
You know, straight away. And, you know, and in terms of sort of being in the studio, I like to sort of stay positive and push on and not get bogged down in the little details. And I think in those songwriting sessions where you're doing a track in a day and you're writing a song and, you know, maybe even finishing a record, you know, you want to be making those big decisions about is it the right word? Is it the right sound? Is it the right melody? And, you know, keeping it positive and feeling it. And I think, you know, you don't want to get bogged down in those little details. And always, did that feel quite right? And it was a privilege watching Mikael Eriksson from Stargate record vocals. I mean, he's a master. And he uses Jedi mind tricks. He sort of doesn't get involved in the emotion of it somehow. Mm. He's just like, one more time. That's great. Next one. Next line. Do this. You know, and he's sort of compiling it as he goes along. And he's recorded some amazing vocals. And just seeing how he does it, you know, it's got much to do with, you know, the right microphone and how it sounds on the microphone. And I think I've seen some singers get very, you know, caught up in self-consciousness and sort of sabotaging themselves. Whereas, you know, I think if you just keep going and stay positive, I think those are the best vocals, I think, and where you get caught up in the emotion of it, which reminds me of when James did the vocal for Unbelievable. I think they had a few beers,
right?
And I think Derry went in the vocal booth with James, and they had a couple of beers, and James just sang it, and they were just sort of like dancing around, and did it. I think he did it in one take.
Really?
Yeah.
Sounds like he's loving it.
Yeah.
As an Ivor Novello winning songwriter and Golden Globe nominated songwriter, I have a challenge for you. Here we go. Have you ever thought about writing a song or presenting a song to a major artist that's going to be heard by lots of people that's in a different time signature?
When you say in a different time signature, you mean like...
Rather than 4-4, 3-4, a different type that isn't what is expected on mainstream radio. You've now got the clout to surely be able to do that. And wouldn't it be interesting? It would be different. But how would that go down?
Yeah, but that's sort of contradicting what I've been trying to say. About fitting in and sort of, I didn't say fitting in, but just like connecting to people. And if they thought, you know, the songs are a very simple form. It's like, it hasn't changed much for many, many years. And trying to mess, you know, I keep seeing people that are trying to mess with the form. And I've often seen sort of producers come to me with these things and say they're, oh, we've entered a new type of music. And when they say that, I know it's going to be bad. Right. Because it's just going to sound different and it's not going to be right. And you sort of want to get involved in how to make it right within the form, which, you know, these days is fairly simple, you know. It is 4-4 and melodies are happening in a certain way and sounds are happening in a certain way. And
don't you want to challenge audiences and challenge listeners by maybe doing something a little bit different?
Yeah, you know what, maybe you can.
I mean, there's very, very few, for our listeners, there's very, very few songs in the last 25 years that have been a hit and been in the top 10 charts that hasn't been in 4-4. So it's almost, you know, there's very, very few. But I just thought maybe it'd be something different to bring to the table.
You know, it very possibly would. And sometimes I just write songs for the sake of writing songs and who knows what happens to them. But so far, you know, and there's some songs out there. Amanda and I wrote a song once called Deep Water that changed from 4-4 into 3-4 halfway through. But I just think it just upset everybody who heard it when it changed. They were like, well, what's going on there, you know?
Yeah.
Changing forms.
It would stand out so much on the radio like a sore thumb and be like, oh, well, that's something really, really different that someone's doing. It wouldn't be interchangeable with different things.
Well, Perfect by Ed Sheeran is in 3-time.
Oh, is it? Right.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah, you can mess with those forms. And do you know what? Occasionally I try things, you know. I don't care that much about quite how it fits in, but I do try and make them relevant.
Yeah.
I'm sort of interested in how the words work and the melody works. And that, for me, I find fascinating. 4-4's Still got an awful lot of songs left in it, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I played Take Five to my son the other day.
Right.
That was interesting. Getting him, and he usually listens to Metallica, so he, for him to hear something that was in like that was in five time, I think was interesting. And but kids, you know, kids are open to anything, I suppose. Great if we could invent a new type of music, but I don't know. I don't know that it's going to be me. I think my time for inventing a new type of music is is gone. I love words and melodies and.
And you worked with Florence and the Machine on Bedroom Hymns, is that
right?
Yeah, tell us about that experience.
Wonderful. Again, there's another person with personality pouring out of her.
Yeah.
She's pacing around the room, like ideas pouring out of her. We did that in a studio in New York where Smashing Pumpkins guitarist studio.
Yeah, right.
And he had all these amazing guitars around. And I just sort of picked up this guitar. And did the guitar riff for it. And, you know, again, Amanda and Florence just started riffing on Florence's sort of wail. I mean, she has this wonderful sort of emotion in her voice. And
incredible range. She opens up so much.
Worked with Dave McCracken, who, funnily enough, is Ian Brown's producer.
Oh, right, okay.
And that was the connection with Ian. And he did this great beat, and it just sort of came out in a moment, really. And I think I think that's a special track. It's a shame. I think it could possibly have been a single, or you know, had another version of it. But I remember Baz Luhrmann really loving it because he put it in the Great Gatsby movie.
Did he?
Trailer. He put it on the trailer.
Oh wow.
And that's a great trailer, you know, when that kicks in the party scene.
Right, okay. That's very famous, yeah. Wow. You've worked with some of the most powerful personalities in the music industry. What's their biggest weakness?
I suppose it is a terrible weakness to sort of exist in an ivory tower. And you can't help but in a bit of a bubble when you have that sort of attention. And it's admirable to see how some of those artists have managed to retain some sense of normalcy through all that and kept their feet on the ground and continued to be creative. And I think that's a great strength, but I can see how it's a weakness to be isolated, I think, and have people around you that are going, oh yeah, you're great.
Yes, people. Yes, men.
Yes, people.
Yeah.
It's so easy to surround yourself. It's so nice to surround yourself with people who are going like, oh, yeah, you're what a great idea. Even when it's not. And I think you've got to be a tough person to know when you're getting good advice, even if it's not what you want to hear. Because when the whole world's telling you you're great, surely you're great, you know. But when you're trying to do, you know, more music and, you know, things are different and, you know, might not, you know, is that difficult second album syndrome, isn't it? Or difficult fifth album or seventh album, you know, it's like, how do you get to be good? And I think it was interesting seeing Beyonce. We did some playback sessions when we were working on the I Am Sasha Fierce album, and so after the day was done, everybody went into one studio and played all the songs. And we did one day when we played a bunch of songs, and Stargate played some, and Tricky and Dream were there and they played some, and Amanda and I played a couple of songs, and you know, everyone was like punching in the air and going, oh, they're sounding great. And this was a time when Beyonce's father was still managing her. Mr. Knowles was there and listening to it all, and so when it was finished, he's like, yeah, but where's your pop hit at 128 beats per minute? And you know, you could see Beyonce was slightly frustrated by this. You know, yeah, but these, you know, these songs are great, these are hit songs. And he's like, yeah, but you haven't got an upbeat song for the radio. Day later, 2 days later, we did the playback session, and there was Single Ladies.
Really? Oh, wow. So his input actually... Oh, wow.
So, you know...
That's interesting.
It's good that you've got somebody there...
Yeah.
...going, you've got to...
You've got to have a critical friend, haven't you?
You've got to have a critical friend.
Yeah, someone who's going to...
You've got to have someone who's sort of going to sort of keep you on the straight and narrow. And
so from recording with Beyonce to recording with Vic and Bob...
You've been dying to ask about this, haven't you?
This is the highlight. Larvik and Bob. So no, joke aside. So in with EMF, you released a single, didn't you?
Yeah.
It wasn't Disney. It was I'm a believer. That was it. Yeah. Right, yeah. And I watched it today. You were on Top of the Pops and like you dressed as the monkey and stuff. Was that something you really wanted to do, or was that something that you know? How did that come about?
Yeah, Vic and Bob had done the single with the Wonder Stuff.
That's right. Dizzy.
Yeah.
And
I think they loved indie music and they loved working with yeah. sort of bands they liked.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, let's do I'm a Believer. And
how did you guys become involved in it?
I think I used to just bump into Jim Moyer, Vic Reeves, occasionally, and Bob Mortimer, and like in the Grouch or something, and.
Mm.
And they were like, oh, yeah, no, we should do something together.
Wow.
You know, probably just like and like, oh, yeah, let's try it. I think they had tried I'm a Believer on some TV show and played it back and said, oh, let's go, you know, and it sounded great. So we said, yeah, let's do this. And it was just, we just thought we'd have some fun and give it a go. And
it was a hit.
It was a hit again, back to you know, like a bit of fun and a press story is...
Mm.
It's always a great backdrop to a record.
I watched it earlier, so it is on YouTube for anybody who wants to have a look for it. So quite a serious question here, but what was your biggest setback in your career? And how did you approach overcoming it?
I know James and I are always tortured by how EMF was such a great idea in its first incarnation as a sort of bad boy pop band.
Mm-hmm.
And I think us trying to be something else sort of ended up being something very complicated, you know, and then we went off and did different things. And I think it's a real shame because, you know, James and I still have such great chemistry and I think we should have just kept making records mm-hmm. and we could have figured it out. Hey, listen, we can still make a record. I'm going to remedy it by making another record with James.
Awesome, do it.
EMF.
Do it.
Because those relationships are precious in your life. Music's about chemistry with people, you know, and when you have a really great chemistry, I think you should just make it. But bands are also like marriages and, you know, and you can just get involved with things and fall out about things and about silly things, and creativity trumps all that. And I think you just need to, you know, keep doing that. And I think, you know, and the same with Amanda and mm-hmm. and other things I've been involved with. You know, I think that when you meet somebody and you have a good chemistry and you make good music, that's precious. That's what records are. They're sort of like the record of a precious interaction between people. And that's why bands are great. You know, the sound, those people, when you get
camaraderie
together, there's a camaraderie in the way people play and put things together, and that's really special. And it does make me sad to think of all those relationships and all those sort of situations that perhaps I don't, you know, that I'm not still doing, you know, and I wish I could still be doing everything I always did. And I managed to write a bunch of hit records in 2008 with Amanda, and I know Amanda became very troubled by having to churn it out, I think. And that's a shame.
She was part of a machine then that was
that really troubled her, and I think she wanted to move on to other things because she couldn't just churn it out. You know, it had to mean something to her, and I think and she does right now when she feels it's something that she can relate to and feel, and she's great when she does that, and I think it has to be something like that. And it's a shame that we didn't continue writing pop hits, really, but you know, it's fine. Onto other things. And
what's your funniest or fondest memories of EMF? So you had some wild times in the band. You had some wild times. What are your funniest or fondest memories?
I don't know what the ones... I don't know what I can repeat on.
Yeah, repeat on
record.
Yeah.
I don't know that I can, but I mean, it was they're just you know, great fun. They were just love, you know. You know, we had such a brilliant time. We were, I mean, I think I was the old man of the band. I was 25, and James and Mark were 21, and Derry and Zach were 18, and we
wow.
hit records.
That's young, isn't it?
So,
that is young.
And so,
did you feel like you were the captain? I mean, from a songwriting point of view, you were anyway, but did you feel a responsibility?
I tried, but I didn't have a chance of controlling that lot, you know. I mean, when we played the Universal Amphitheatre in Los Angeles, I think that was 6,000 people, and that was our, you know, we sold it out.
Nice.
And that was a great moment, and I think we broke the T-shirt record that had been set by Faith No More or something before that, and we saw more T-shirts than Faith No More, and we were like, yay.
Wow.
Top of the Pops. That's a great moment.
Tell us about that whole experience from when you arrive on Top of the Pops to when you leave. What's that like?
We grew up watching Top of the Pops, and for younger people, they won't understand the resonance of that, but, you know...
But it was there's four channels at the time in the UK, and Top of the Pops on maybe Thursday or Friday night, 7 o'clock or 7:30, the whole nation really watched it.
To see what was happening in music. If there wasn't the internet then, you know, I'd spent my life watching Top of the Pops and going upstairs and playing my guitar afterwards because I wanted to be on Top of the Pops. I wanted to play... I remember seeing Back of Love by Echo and the Bunnymen and just like going upstairs and like playing it and just... And to actually be on there for the first time was incredible.
So what was that whole day? Who else was on the bill the first time you did it? Can you remember?
The first time? I can't remember.
Mm.
I remember being on there once and Kylie Minogue and Jason Donovan were on there.
Especially for you?
I think it was that. And
I probably watched that as like a 6-year-old. Watched that,
Jason Donovan came into our dressing room and came and hung out with us.
Really?
Yeah. And it was like, he was up for it as well. He enjoyed hanging out. Sadly, we didn't persuade Kylie to come in, but...
Yeah.
But...
And did you play live or was it to a backing track?
Well, they had this weird thing back in the day where it was meant to be live. So I think you were meant to record the backing track live and then James sang live on top of it.
Right, okay.
So
you were all miming and James sang, but so you could have a bit of fun.
So yeah.
So that must have been obviously such a highlight for you. What were the stories you tell your friends?
Playing in Japan. You know, I mean, well, you go all that way and people know you. And Japan's so strange as well because, you know, I remember everybody in Japan, like the girls would put their bags on the side of the venue and nobody would steal them. And then at the end of the thing, they just grab their bags and they'd go. And there wouldn't be one, you know, beer can or on the floor afterwards. It was, you know...
But you had other gigs where, I mean, I watched an interview with you about 25 years ago, maybe about 20 years ago, and it was mayhem, like people were throwing glasses at the stage and that kind of thing. And
that's so funny because I played a couple of weeks ago at Yulu with Goldheart Assembly, their friends. And the last time I played that venue was supporting Carter just after we sort of had a hit record. And our management had a record label and Carter had released some records with our management's record label. So we had a connection and they said, oh, do you want to come and support us? And we were like, yeah, that'd be great. You know, we liked this sort of, they were cool and we wanted to be part of that. And I think they liked that, you know, we were hit at the time. So that was sort of funny. And we came on stage and they had this really hardcore audience and their audience started throwing bottles at us. And like,
was that expected before you went out there?
We knew it might be a little bit edgy,
yeah,
or you know that they might be a little bit of disapproval, but you know we were gen, you know, if you see us play live, it's got a real energy and it's you know, we're quite a tough band, you know, we're a great live band, and people started throwing things at us, and then I think Milf jumped in the audience and tried to say something to somebody and somebody hit him, and then and it was literally this fight broke out, you know, with the front row of the audience and us, and it just was absolute mayhem. And I remember Neil Tennant was at the gig.
Oh, really?
Because he was on Parlophone and we were on Parlophone and they got invited. Oh, and he said afterwards, oh, it just reminded me of the punk gigs, he said. And,
really?
And
amazing.
And fun. It had a great energy, but it was a bit scary.
Oh, man. So we'll talk about EMF, and obviously there was a sad period in the band's history when EMF lost a member, Zach Foley, in tragic circumstances at the age of 31 in 2002. I wonder if you could pay tribute to Zach, both as a person and a musician. So what did EMF lose that day as an individual and also from a musical perspective?
You know, Zach was my friend, and I think he was, you know, everybody's friend. Derry and Zach grew up together, and
right,
you know, what can you say? I mean, it's like you just lose somebody special, and he was very funny, and you know, he had a great energy, and you know, it's funny you say to me, what am I going to tell my kids about? And you know, I think that's, I'm going to say, watch out, because you know, there's, you know, drugs are out there, and you know, you get involved in that, and it's not something where you can necessarily be in control. And you know, I just think, you know, he got involved in drugs, and you know, they took him away, and you know, just, you know, that's a terrible part of the music industry, I think. And you know, I don't know. I don't know what to say, really.
And as a musician, as a, because he was the bassist.
Yeah,
is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, he just had a great energy, and you know, a great feel, and you know, I think perhaps it was his energy as a person more than anything.
Yeah.
When we started out as a band, and he was just so up and funny, and that. That's what lent a lot of that energy to that first album, and that, you know, really? It had that sort of
encapsulated.
Yeah, the feel, yeah. And all of it, you know, him and Derry too. You know, they have a great sort of. They used to love listening to Primus.
Oh yeah,
Johnny
yeah.
was a race car driver. I just remember Zach playing that all the time, and you know, so. You know, I think we tried to channel that with some house piano, and that's what EMF was, you know, Zach leaping around to Johnny was a race car driver with some house piano on it.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for talking about that so honestly. And you talked about kind of, or touched upon advice to young musicians. It's obviously a very broad question, but other than what you discussed there about drugs, what are the things that you think musicians, young musicians at a young age going into the industry need to be aware of?
That it's hard. Mm-hmm. I think the greatest thing about being a musician is that you sort of got to be a positive person. You know, you wake up every day and you're making something out of nothing. And that's a wonderful thing, but you've got to kind of keep believing, and it is a blessing to be able to do that and to make it work. And you know, have some small victories, and you know, I'm fortunate enough to have, you know, made a living at it, and had a few records, but it's certainly been touch and go. You know, I've had years when it's been hard, but I don't know. I just, maybe I'm a selfish person, because I just, it's what makes me happy, and I just do it anyway, and I'm lucky that I can, and it is a form of selfishness, you know, because you just want to articulate what you feel and put it out there. And when I was young, a young musician, it just lit up my life to play the guitar and to hear the guitar, and I just remember that feeling, you know, in my first punk band, jumping about on stage, and I just want to feel that. Now, I think so. Just if you're a young musician and you feel something, just follow that road wherever it takes you. And
sage advice. Thank you very much. What's the most precious piece of music memorabilia you own?
I have a guitar signed by Robbie Krieger, the guitarist of The Doors.
Really?
Yeah.
And you loved them growing up, didn't you? You
liked The Doors. Yeah, I read that. The Doors growing up.
Wow.
And. You know, my first band was an attempt to be in the Doors. Basically. And I worked out all his guitar solos. Thankfully I got a Gibson record, rather Gibson guitars, gave me an endorsement when EMF was doing well. And the guy from Gibson said to me, oh, who's your favourite guitarist? I said, well, Robbie Krieger. Okay, and
that's what it was. Okay,
yeah, he was just like okay, and then we played a show at in Los Angeles, and the guy from Gibson came down. He said, "Oh, there's somebody I want you to meet."
No.
And he brought Robbie Krieger backstage. And somebody took a photograph of me and Robbie Krieger, like, talking, and I'm there like that, with my mouth open, catching flies. And there's Robbie Krieger sort of looking at me.
Have you got that photo?
I have got that photo somewhere. It's got to be somewhere.
Yeah.
And I couldn't say a word to him. I was just dumbfounded, and he just gave me this guitar that the guy from Gibson got a Gibson SG, which was Robbie Krieger's guitar.
Wow.
And he signed it to Ian, you're unbelievable, Robbie Krieger at the Doors.
Nice.
That's a beautiful thing.
That's priceless.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know that, and I know that from the research how much the Doors meant to you, and particularly him. So that is worth it all. That is absolutely
that's a great moment.
Two last questions. First one, what ambitions do you still have left?
Just to keep writing good songs, I guess.
Mm.
Yeah, it's funny, a couple of writer friends of mine have got involved in writing musicals.
Interesting.
And, you know, and then recently I tried writing some lyrics for a musical because somebody was needed, and that was great fun.
Mm.
I don't know. I mean, musicals, sometimes some musicals, you know, are not great. But I saw Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Recently, with Tim Minchin, did that, and that was great.
Was it good? Yeah.
Oh, he did such a great job. And I don't know. Maybe there's something to do in my dotage. Yeah, and that seems like a...
That'd be a different challenge, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's interesting because certainly the thing I was trying recently had a... You know, the melody was already written and the story was written and the music was written. Mm. And so you just had to try and encapsulate the story point in a song at that moment. But in a funny way, that's what I've been doing my whole life, you know, trying to tell a little story in a song. And so maybe that's the next thing.
What fears do you have for the music industry, and how might those fears be addressed?
Fears slightly. That's a tough one. I don't know. I think the music industry sort of feels like it's in rude health, because I know the streaming thing is bringing some more revenue back into the industry that was lost during the pirating era.
Mm.
And fears for the music industry. Sometimes you think, oh my God, where are the next big things going to come from? Because there seem to be lots of new things. But I think that's a sort of case of perspective.
Mm.
You know, so, you know, from where we're looking now, it seems like in the past there were always these great things, and now there's a lot of okay things and a few good things. But I think if you look back in the past, you know, there were loads of okay things then as well. You've just forgotten them. And so I don't know. I don't have many fears for the music industry. I think there's loads of young people out there making great music. I love new, edgy things, you know. I love Skepta, and I love, you know, and I'm too old for it, but I just I love seeing people doing edgy, creative things, and just like they always did. So I have no fears for the music industry. I think young people will continue making great music, and long may it continue.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. There's an acoustic guitar there. Could you play the riff to Unbelievable? Is it tuned?
We can tune it, can't we? Even if we can't. Not. That's one thing I can... Whoa,
thank you so much, Ian, for appearing on the Stage Left podcast. You've contributed to songs that are going to be played for generations and generations to come. Keep up the good work. We hope you enjoyed appearing, and thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Thank you very much.
For more episodes featuring Guns N' Roses guitarist Richard Fortus, Tony Visconti on producing David Bowie's final album Black Star, the comedian Stuart Lee on his creative processes, Ezra Furman, Wolfgang Fleur of Kraftwerk, Gem Archer of Oasis, and George Vajestica of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, go to thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at thestageleftpod, like us at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast, and come say hi on our Instagram page as well, where you'll see all the photos of all the interviews we do, and let us know where you're listening from. We hope you enjoyed the episode, and we'll see you next month for Dan McDougall of Liam Gallagher's band.